Well, we're going to kind of pick up on that theme, so to speak, with Dr. Siegel's case.
Okay. This is a 54-year-old premenopausal woman. She had a right segmental mastectomy and sentinel lymph node study. Her pathology revealed a 1.4 by 0.8 centimeter moderately differentiated invasive ductal carcinoma. Estrogen progesterone receptor was positive. HER2-new was negative. She had 4 negative sentinel lymph nodes. We placed her on a clinical trial, CALGB 40101, and she was randomized to receive 4 cycles of Taxol, 175 milligrams per meter squared every 2 weeks for 4 doses, which she received. She then received therapeutic irradiation to the breast. At this point, she ceased menses. I checked estradiol, FSH, and LH, and they were in the postmenopausal range.
Can you talk about her past history and her feelings about hormonal therapy?
Her mother actually had a history of breast cancer and was placed on adjuvant tamoxifen and had a severe complication, a DVT and pulmonary embolus. So she had great concerns, and actually when we went through the discussion of adjuvant hormonal therapy, just categorically refused to take tamoxifen because of her experience with her mother.
George, could you first comment, again picking up this concept of dose dense, on this CALGB study in node-negative patients? Kind of an interesting study. It's sort of each half of the dose dense versus non-dose dense. So it's ACQ 2 weeks versus A3Q 3 weeks, Taxol Q 2 weeks versus Taxol Q 3 weeks. The thing that's interesting is the idea of using dose dense single agent.
Yes. Well, I think if we go back and look at the database that we have for dose dense therapy in breast cancer, it derives largely from trial C9741, which was a CALGB-led trial in which patients were randomized either in a 2x2 comparison. One of the 2x2 comparisons didn't work, so we can forget it. But the second one was comparing Q3-week to Q2-week, AC followed by T. And that trial, which was reported several years ago and then very recently updated by Cliff Huddis at this last year's San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, is a trial that shows a statistically significant benefit for the use of dose-dense AC followed by T. Now, if one looks at the subsets in that trial, pretty much all of the benefit in the trial appears to be focused on the population of patients that is an estrogen receptor negative population. I find this very interesting looking at this patient, who is, of course, an estrogen receptor positive patient. There's a number of things that we don't know about 9741. First, that was probably the last adjuvant trial that we'll ever do that had a significant component of HER2-positive breast cancer patients that did not receive or were not randomized to receive or not receive trastuzumab. So when we say that there is a benefit for the estrogen receptor negative population, we actually don't know, because it hasn't been presented yet, whether or not that's the triple negative population or the ER-PR negative HER2-positive population that's getting benefit, so which is a very interesting thing. If it turned out, for instance, that the benefit was largely in the HER2-positive population, what would we make of that today in the era of adjuvant trastuzumab? I don't think we know. The other thing that we don't know in this trial is that because we were dose-densifying everything, we don't have any good sense of whether or not dose densification of AC is valuable or dose densification of paclitaxel is valuable. And so we're left with a trial where the results, while the statisticians appropriately tell us should not be applied to subsets anyway, suggest a benefit for a fairly narrow subset of patients and don't give us the crucial information of which drug we should be dose densifying or whether or not it should be limited to triple-negative patients, HER2-positive patients, or whatever. This trial hopefully will allow us to answer some of those questions in that we are looking at specific agents like paclitaxel or the combination of AC rather than the whole shebang of AC followed by T, and I think that'll be very interesting. It also perhaps give us some sense, because this trial allows both ER-positive and ER-negative patients to enter the trial, some sense in the long run of whether or not the results we saw in 9741 were an artifact, which is certainly one possible interpretation, or whether or not that estrogen receptor positivity not benefiting from dose densification is a biologic reality.
Peter, we know from our patterns of care surveys that right now dose dense AC paclitaxel is by far the most common regimen used in node-positive patients and high-risk node-negative patients in the United States. What are your thoughts about dose dense therapy and how it stacks up, for example, versus TAC, particularly in the ER-positive patient?
I think that there's an ongoing clinical trial right now, NSABP B38, which is actually addressing that question, and it's randomizing patients between TAC and dose dense therapy. I think that trial is incredibly important because, first of all, the comparator regimens for both dose dense therapy and also TAC were quite different. So we don't really, by indirect ways, have a very good measure of how efficacious these two regimens are. The TAC-FAC study, which is BCRG-001, is a smaller study. And so it doesn't have quite the subset power that 9341 had. However, it does appear in the TAC study that the arm that got the taxane benefited equally in ER positives and ER negatives. Now, the long pull of history says that subset analyses are as often wrong as they are right. And so I think that this is a good trial, and I think that both ER positive and ER negative patients should go on this trial so that once and for all we will get the definitive answer as to which regimen is more effective, and secondly, whether or not there is a subset effect. Now, if you believe all the results of the subset analyses so far, my take on this is that they're going to be equal in the ER negative patients, and the TAC is going to be better in the ER positive patients. But over and over again, we've seen recently subset analyses that have not been reproduced. And let me just give an example. In the ATAC trial, it appeared that the ER positive, PGR negative patients were the ones who particularly benefited from getting an aromatase inhibitor. And the chance of that result, the p-value suggested the chance of that result was 1 in 10,000, okay? But there are lots of possible subset analyses that could have been done. And when a very analogous trial, the big study, the FEMTA study, looking at an analogous kind of clinical design comparing letrozole and tamoxifen was done, actually there was no correlation between PGR and the apparent benefit of one versus the other. In fact, there was a trend in the opposite direction. So I think we have to be very careful in reading the tea leaves from subset analyses. And I really think that B38 is a great trial and hopefully will answer these questions for us.
45-year-old woman with an ER positive, 3 positive node tumor. Peter, in general, what chemotherapy, HER2 negative, are you generally going to use?
I think that if the patient is not going to go on to trial, I like TAC in that situation better than the dose-dense therapy.
George?
I think either TAC or dose-dense AC followed by T is a reasonable approach for that patient.
I assume that when you use TAC, Peter, you're going to use growth factors?
Yes.
Gary Lyman told me recently that he does these large patterns of care studies. He's finding that there are a substantial number of patients treated in the community with TAC without growth factors. Does that surprise you?
I think that most people that have extensive experience with TAC have seen a lot of neutropenia and fever with this. And of course, the reported rate is 24%, and I think that the community experience is a lot like that. I'd like to add one other possible strategy here, and that is that we haven't really discussed other advanced taxane regimens other than TAC. And I think that the regimens that have been developed in Europe, which are based on FEC, 5-FU, epirubicin, cytoxin, and then have additional cycles of a taxane afterwards, look to me in indirect comparisons to be as good as TAC and dose-dense therapy. And perhaps those regimens should be more widely used. Unfortunately, they haven't been any part of the American clinical trial scenario, but they do look like good regimens.
I think we should also point out the NSABP B38 study does have a third arm, which is dose-dense AC paclitaxel with gemcitabine. George, what are your thoughts about using dose-dense AC every 2 weeks with growth factors off study? And that's going to be kind of a theme that comes up this afternoon. If something has made it to be an arm on a major randomized study, can you therefore justify utilizing it in practice? What do you think about dose-dense AC?
Well, our dose densification data is with AC followed by T, I guess is the simple answer. If we're talking about dose-dense therapy as a means of getting the patient through their adjuvant therapy quicker and perhaps a little bit more safely because there's a lower rate of neutropenic fever and money is not an issue, then I don't think it's a particular problem. I certainly would have no objections to it.
Peter?
I feel strongly that that's not a good idea. First of all, there's no safety data for that regimen is an independent regimen.
Of course there is, Peter.
Well, okay, indirectly.
If it's safe in AC followed right, by right, T, right. then it's safe for AC.
That's not my primary objection. My primary objection is that, in fact, there is a second dose-dense trial that never gets discussed. It's an Italian study in which they dose-densified FEC. And this is a straight-up Norton hypothesis, no dose reduction, but given every 3 weeks versus every 2 weeks. And in that study, the patients who got the dose-dense regimen did not get additional benefit compared to those that got the every three-week regimen, which actually interestingly argues that maybe it's only the dose-densification of the taxane portion. So I don't think that there's good clinical trial evidence that you're really likely to, by just dose-densifying the AC portion, that you're going to make it more efficacious. And you're going to make it enormously more expensive.
Yeah, well, I qualified my earlier statement by saying if you want to get the therapy through quicker and safer and cost is not an issue, then it's a reasonable thing to do. And I would agree, Peter, I don't think we have any efficacy data for AC as a dose-dense regimen.
Right. I think that the regimen may be too short already, since I'm kicking a dead horse here. And the other thing is that I would say that it's 12 weeks versus 8 weeks doesn't really strike me as that revolutionary. And quite frankly, AC is a fairly safe regimen all by itself, and it's not clear to me other than that you might make it risky by giving it every 2 weeks and then give the growth factors to get rid of that extra risk. But I don't think of AC as something we need to figure out a way to give more safely and quickly.
Law, does it make any difference at all what chemo we gave this lady because she's a T1 N0 ER positive. We just stopped her menses with the chemo. So I would humbly say it doesn't matter what chemo we gave. I'm glad she was on a clinical trial. But using the adjuvant online in your mind, Peter, what percentage of her benefit is going to come from us killing her menses and putting on an aromatase inhibitor versus from chemo? I would suggest the chemo benefit's probably small.
It's interesting to me that we have this fearsome debate about how to treat this stage one breast cancer patient, when in fact, for these advanced regimens, we have no data of how they work in stage one patients. Interestingly enough, I think that most of us, and I would reflect that even the NCCN this time, in their guidelines for adjuvant therapy, they always used to distinguish between regimens that were for node-positive versus node-negative patients. Now they actually have abandoned that, and so they feel that the regimens can be defended broadly, irrespective of nodal status. At any rate, I think that these regimens haven't really been tested in node-negative patients. And to come back to your point, I think that, yes, most of the benefit, or at least half the benefit for these patients, is going to be hormonal therapy. It'll be interesting to come around to that point of the discussion, because this woman needs to understand that the most important part of her therapy probably is the hormonal therapy rather than the chemotherapy.
Let's move on to the hormonal part of this question. Peter, this woman has ceased menstruation with chemotherapy. She's 54 years old, menstruating regularly up until that time, very much does not want to receive tamoxifen.
Well, I think that for a woman who is recently postmenopausal, there are two reasonable options for therapy. One of them would be tamoxifen, the other would be aromatase inhibitors. And clinical trials show that aromatase inhibitors certainly provide the woman with a better disease-free survival over the next 5 years. So she should consider taking an aromatase inhibitor. Now, there's one caveat to that, and that is that I think many of us have had patients who've stopped menstruating when they were given chemotherapy. And it's been looked at, and those patients, even though they appear to be postmenopausal endocrinologically, a reasonable percentage of those patients start menstruating again. I haven't actually seen the data broken out by, say, 5-year period. But as we all know, the closer you get to menopause, the more likely you are to go through menopause when you get chemotherapy, and the more likely that the menopause would be permanent. Now, if this woman, for instance, wasn't 54, but she was 44, or particularly 34, and she stopped menstruating when I had given her chemotherapy and then was to give her hormonal therapy, I would definitely give her tamoxifen first.
And she says, I don't want it. My mother had a pulmonary embolus.
So in this case, there are two reasons why I would go to aromatase inhibitors as the primary therapy and not consider tamoxifen. The first is, I think that if she's 54, she's one of those people that statistically I think is likely to stop menstruating with the chemotherapy and not restart. And so secondly, obviously this patient doesn't want to get hormonal therapy, specifically tamoxifen. And I think that she would probably be easily educated that the problems that her mother faced are not things that are problems caused by aromatase inhibitors. And therefore, I would expect that with that knowledge, she would feel comfortable getting an aromatase inhibitor. And she should understand that the aromatase inhibitor is going to give her as much benefit as the chemotherapy.
And if she were 33, exact same situation?
In exact same situation, what I would do is I would start with tamoxifen for the first couple of years.
She refuses it.
I would suggest that she undergo oophorectomy. But actually, I've never done an oophorectomy in a young woman who stopped menstruating. So I think what you'd do in a younger woman is you would just inform her that if she didn't want to take tamoxifen, that she needed to be monitored for the start of ovarian function. And if ovarian function did restart, that she should then consider an oophorectomy.
If she had an oophorectomy or an Ehlers Danlos agonist, would you then add an AI on top of that?
Actually, I wouldn't. I think, although there are clinical trials going on to see if AIs do add to oophorectomy or ovarian suppression, because both strategies do the same thing. Both strategies, an oophorectomy and an AI, would both drop your hormonal levels. It's not clear to me that dropping them twice is better than once. So I would feel fairly satisfied with giving her, on the basis of current data, ovarian suppression alone, and wouldn't feel compelled to give her an AI as well.
And you talked about the strategy of using, in a premenopausal woman who's stopped menstruation, tamoxifen for a couple years and then switching to an AI. Can you talk a little bit more about how you would do that and where blood monitoring would come in?
Well, I think that the thing you would do immediately after the chemotherapy, you would take a look at her gonadotropin and estradiol levels. Then after 2 to 3 years in which she remained amenorrheic, you could measure them again. Now, you do have to take into account the fact that tamoxifen itself, if the patient's taking tamoxifen, will perturb the gonadotropin levels. It won't give you estradiol, but it will actually cause the gonadotropin levels to be lower than they would be in full-blown menopause. It acts as a partial estrogen in the pituitary, and so you can be slightly misled if you don't also look at estradiol level as well. I think that even after 2 to 3 years, there's a chance that this woman's going to start menstruating again if she's very young. So you could, if you wanted to, continue out through the full 5 years of tamoxifen. The data suggests that patients actually might do a little bit better if you switched over to an AI.
There's a question, Dennis?
I was going to say, if she were at much higher risk, node positivity or multiple node positivity, would you feel more strongly about adding an AI to that situation? And a 34-year-old who entered menopause with chemotherapy, who biochemically was in a menopause.
Actually, it wouldn't influence me. And the reason why is that I have had a couple patients in that kind of situation that have started menstruating. And then I felt absolutely awful because I realized that a lot of the risk actually occurs in the first 2 to 3 years. So if somebody you're seeing every few months comes in and then suddenly tells you that they just had a menstrual period, you can think, oh, well, you know, I haven't given this woman any effective hormonal therapy if I was giving her an AI. So you have to balance that scenario against the scenario that, yes, maybe you would get some additional benefit from the AI over giving tamoxifen. So in my mind, I want to be sure that everybody gets some hormonal therapy. And tamoxifen itself is a pretty good drug. I mean, the AIs add marginally over the top, but it's not like tamoxifen is a drug that should be looked down on.
George, again, 54-year-old lady, doesn't want to receive tamoxifen, has stopped having menstrual periods.
Well, I think she's pretty simple. I'd put her on an aromatase inhibitor. If you go back to the younger age groups that we've talked about, the 34-year-old and the 44-year-old, I absolutely agree with Peter. I'd be very uncomfortable because I've been fooled on more than one occasion into thinking that a woman was postmenopausal based on FSH and estradiol levels that were clearly postmenopausal and then were followed several months later by real honest-to-gosh periods. So in a younger woman, if the woman refused tamoxifen, I would probably opt for ovarian ablation, perhaps with an AI, though, again, there's a case where we have no data. In a 54-year-old woman, though, who's received adjuvant chemotherapy, I actually think we're probably reasonably comfortable for most patients. I won't say for all, because always and never are, you know, two words always to remember, never to use. But for most 54-year-old women who cease menses with chemotherapy, they're not going to get those menses back, and certainly giving them an aromatase inhibitor is eminently rational.
So Dr. Siegel, can you follow up with the case?
Yes. In October 2004, she started Arimidex. However, in April 2005, her menses recurred.
Okay. Hoist by his own petard. Yes.
And I rechecked estradiol, FSH, LH, and they were now in the premenopausal range. So we had another discussion. She still refused to take tamoxifen. So I talked about ovarian ablation, and she opted for Depo-Lupron, which we started. And down the line, I checked the hormone levels again. They were postmenopausal. And interestingly, about 6 or 12 months later, she was having hot flashes, and she insisted on stopping the Depo-Lupron, which I did. But again, she developed menses and became premenopausal. So she's now on Depo-Lupron and Arimidex.
Well, as I said, always and never are two words always to remember, never to use.
How long would you continue the LHRH agonist, Peter, in this situation?
Well, I think that right now the North American clinical trial data with the adjuvant effects of LHRH analogs is for 5 years. I would note that that's on the basis of no really strong information, that whether or not it should be longer is unclear to me. For a patient like this, at this age, the chances are that with 5 years of time going by that she's probably going to be postmenopausal, so I wouldn't feel uncomfortable stopping it. One of the reasons why people sometimes give LHRH analogs is purposefully to set somebody up so they can restart and become pregnant afterwards, so that in a young patient, it's not unusual after 5 years to restart. And whether or not you might benefit by a longer period, particularly for a high-risk patient, is really not clear.
Dr. Hendricks, you had a question?
I do have a question about how to estimate the vascular risks with these endocrine agents. It sounds like this woman was consumed with the vascular risk associated with tamoxifen. So I wonder how you quantitate that for this patient to try to correct her risk estimate for having a vascular complication of tamoxifen, and if you discuss the potential vascular risks of the aromatase inhibitors.
Peter, can you kind of review the data that we have now in terms of this issue of actually really coronary disease with the three different agents?
Well, I should say one thing about tamoxifen first. There is very detailed information from the P1 trial about age-specific cardiac risk. So you can quote numbers to a person by age of thrombotic events. For the adjuvant trials with aromatase inhibitors, these are big trials but with shorter follow-up. In the ATAC trial, there was no evidence of excess cardiac risk. And so that was kind of reassuring, particularly because people were concerned as to whether or not these agents might, by not having some of the effects on cholesterol that some of the studies with tamoxifen have suggested, might be protective, that these agents might push things in the opposite direction. In the IES trial, the International Exemestane study, there was an excess in cardiac mortality. Now, this was one of those things done in multiple subsets. So there's an argument as to what the p-value is for that. And there is a camp that worries over this, and I think all of us do worry whenever we see an excess. There were some issues in that trial, though. If you took a look at all events, cardiac and thrombotic events, irrespective of grade, you didn't actually see the excess. You saw the excess only when you looked at 3, 4, 5 category of events. So whether or not that's real or something based on subsets is, I think, still an unsettled question. In the big study, there was also a trend for more cardiac events. In that study, I do not believe it reached statistical significance, but it raised the question as to whether or not there might be another shoe to fall in the late follow-up of aromatase inhibitors. So I would say that there's no definitive evidence at this time that aromatase inhibitors cause an excess risk of cardiovascular disease, but I think it's still an open question. And one of the things that I would note in the ATAC trial is that an overall survival advantage hasn't emerged. And that means when you see that the breast cancer-specific mortality, actually that there's a strong trend for that improving, it suggests that maybe there's something going on with non-breast cancer-related mortality. But that question has been raised repeatedly, and they've looked at their data and don't see any concentrated number of events in cardiovascular risk or thrombotic risk. So I think that we have more to learn about the long-term toxicity of these agents. But I don't tell anybody that they shouldn't take these agents because of cardiovascular risk. The other thing to point out is the excess risk that we're talking about here. One of the reasons why we're unsure about it is that the actual numbers are like 1% versus 0.5%. So part of the reason why we're not statistically sure is because the numbers are so low. And compared to the probable benefits of these agents, they're low.